Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen, so you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcast. That's gotomeeting.com/podcast for a free trial. And welcome aboard to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz. We're up to episode 182, and I'm so glad that you're with me today. We have lots to talk about because we've seen a lot of volatility late, a lot of shaky action, a lot of big moves up, and then kind of gradual moves down, and then some sloppiness in the markets. We'll talk about that a little bit with our guest, Tom McClellan. And we're also going to talk about a question I have regarding some specific cycles. And then we're going to talk about questions that you have. You've sent me a tremendous amount of questions regarding all sorts of topics, and they've been great. Of course, you're going to send me anything you want to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and I'll do my best to answer it and research as best as possible. I know a lot of you have been waiting for some answers to questions, and I am going to spend some time after I talk with Tom about that in particular. And of course, if you want to find out more about Tom McClellan, about what we've talked about in the past, last week when we had Mr. O'Neill on from Investors Business Daily, we also had Behind the Numbers, just check out the show notes over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So let's just start it right off with, I have on the phone with us already, Tom McClellan, a good friend of mine and someone who I kind of bounce some ideas off and sometimes some of the nuttier ones, because Tom is a great guy that can look at the details and the data and rip it apart, put it back together, and tell me if I am totally insane or if there's something logical that may be looking at further. So how are you, buddy?
Great. You're very kind to say those things about me.
Oh, well, you are. It's true. It's true. You have a mathematical head. And that's not...
I get annoyed by circumstances where I don't know the answer to something, so right. I try to do a lot of digging into the data to see if the data can give me the answer.
What was your favorite math courses? Which algebra, trig, what?
Well, I went to West Point and I studied aerospace engineering, so there was a lot of math courses. But the nice thing about engineering, as opposed to like selecting wallpaper, there's always an equals sign in every equation right. in engineering. And everything on the left side is equal to everything on the right side.
Right.
So you can figure out what's wrong. You can get to a solution. If you asked me to pick my favorite color, we'd be here all day because I can't even do that.
It's funny you mention that because I talk to my kids a lot about that. And they're like, oh, math, oh my... I said, math is the easiest course because you know there's an answer. And the answer is only one answer. I mean, yeah, sometimes you can have two answers. But I'm saying, generally speaking, you know there's a way to get somewhere, like in geometry, that's a map. You start over here. You know you have to get over there. And somehow you have to fill in the details. And that's it. End of sentence. You can only do it one way, and that's it. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about something I know you've been writing about. And actually, I talk about cycles with John Dvorak on that podcast. I am not a big cycles guy, but I don't want to let you talk about this. You're kind of hot on this whole idea of the presidential cycle. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I can understand your reticence to embrace cycles, because if you are going to believe that there are cycles in the financial markets and that they matter, then you have to kind of believe that there's a little bit of predeterminism that's going on. Mm-hmm. Like we're not even actually in charge, that something else is in charge. Whether that's crowd psychology, it's fluctuating on a natural rhythm, or whether it's planets, or whether it's the calendar, or the sun, or who knows what. But if you're going to accept cycles, you have to be willing to suspend the belief that you have control over things. And that's a hard thing for a lot of people to do. The presidential cycle is one that makes a lot of sense, though, because it's tied to our political calendar. And basically, for people not familiar with it, what technicians like me do is that we chop up the data into four-year chunks of time, and then we average together the market's performance over each of those four-year chunks of time. Sort of like when people do seasonality, where they say the first week of September is bad 63% of the time or whatever. It's the same idea, except that you're extending the year from 1 year to 4 years.
Right.
Generally speaking, the first 2 years of a presidential term are bad for the stock market, especially when you have a new president in office.
Mm-hmm.
The third year of a presidential term is nearly always an up year for the stock market, and election year is an iffier time. One thing that I do differently than other people, I count the start of the year as being November 1st instead of January 1st, because the election takes place the first Tuesday in November, and the stock market typically starts reacting to whoever got elected rather than wait until he gets inaugurated. So, you also have the midterm election in November, the second year of a presidential term, and there's usually a market reaction to that.
All right, so this November, we have two things. We have the midterm elections coming up, right, in this November, and already the markets are said to be reacting to the possibility of Republicans at least maybe not taking over, but taking back some of what they've maybe have, and at least being close in one of the House or the Senate, either one. And a lot of bit of concern over the new Independent Party or the Tea Party, whatever they're called at this point. But where are we in terms of the presidential cycle right now? So this November is going to be what? We're going to be in our third year, going into our third year.
Right. We'll be starting the third year of the presidential term in November, the way that I count it. And the third year is generally an up year.
Right.
The last time we had the third year of a presidential term was 2007. Now, 2007 was the start of a lot of bad things, but overall, the market's performance was generally up for that year.
Let's talk about the rationale of that for a second, besides the statistical side of it. Because I know the presidential cycle obviously does have a psychology behind it rather than statistics, in that there is the whole idea of campaigning and stumping and the whole idea of new promises and the potential for something anew, and people are getting like hope and all that, right? Isn't that embedded in that third year?
Exactly. Well, and what a new president does, regardless of whichever party he's been in, what they typically do is they try to get done all the bad stuff in the first year or two. In other words, all their ambitious programs, all the fixing, all the corrections, all the adjustments, they try to get all that done front-loaded. And then they spend the last 2 years running for re-election and telling you how great everything is. So if they want to have something that's going to be hard to take, they want to get it done first so that you have longer to forget it, and longer to forget what a bad job it was in the first year, and that you can instead, when you're voting to re-elect the guy or not, you can focus on how great things have been in the last 2 years of the term.
So that's
generally the model, and they all do it. So it's because of human psychology, and it's because of the structure of our election system that they respond to those incentives, and they do that.
Yeah, I mean, we have to all realize that the idea of the presidency and all that, it's a job, and they want to stay in office. Let's be honest, and that's why they're so busy and always doing what they can to continually go after things. Listen, President Obama is now trying to re-embrace the young generation again, the young voters, and going all over the place where he seemed to have forgotten about them after the election. But that said, we don't want to get too political about this discussion, but the fact is that the political cycles do have some meaning there. And
the market's response to the political cycles is predictable. When people in Washington start talking about things being better, people respond to that, and they start thinking things are better if they hear things are better. And so when they are thinking that things are better, they tend to be more willing to part company with their money and buy stocks, and that pushes up stock prices.
Right.
When things are unknown, when you're told that things are bad, and that this is the worst thing that's ever been, this is the worst recession in 50 years, it's the worst thing, you hear all that stuff, and it kind of bums you out. And so the first 2 years of a presidential term tend to be a bummer for stocks, because people respond to that negative message by reacting negatively and not wanting to buy stocks.
I would think one of the reasons is also that they're reacting to the fact that the other president, especially a new president, is trying to smear and offload a lot of the problems on the previous administration and Congress.
Well, there's some of that, but it's just only the positive message versus the negative message is sticky in the brains of people. Now, the reason why you start seeing the third year, seeing an upmarket in about October or November, right where we are right about now, is that people are investors are fearful of the unknown, and the outcome of the midterm elections is an unknown until it happens.
Right.
There's been less of that this time in 2010 because it's been pretty clear from all of the polling that's gone on that the outcome of this coming election is pretty much known. Mm-hmm. There is going to be a Republican advance in the numbers right. of the seats in Congress. How much of an advance, that's the part still unknown, but investors have a greater sense of what sort of change is going to take place in November. It doesn't matter whether that's good change or bad change. As long as investors get to know what it is, they feel better, and so they are more likely to bid up stock prices.
Right. Now, one of the things that you obviously, and you and I talked about recently, it was actually good for you. This was good for you. What do they say? That any publicity is good, bad, or good, right?
What doesn't matter? As long as you spell my name correctly.
Right, exactly. So there was this thing that came out, I think it was maybe a month and a half ago. It was called the Hindenburg Omen.
It was in August. You're talking about the Hindenburg Omen.
Omen. This is, you know it's not good with that name. It's just not going to be a good thing. You know?
That was an example of great marketing yeah. approach when it comes to naming an indicator.
Right.
I'm not as good at naming indicators.
Right,
that name came from a guy named Kennedy Gamage, who passed away several years ago. He was a newsletter writer, wrote the Richland Report, and he was a big fan of the McClellan Oscillator, the work that my parents did. And the other guy that was behind that, Jim Mika, was the mathematician who came up with it by tweaking some rules that were come up with actually by Gerald Appel many years ago. Jim Mika's idea was to adjust the parameters that Gerald Appel came up with for the expansion in the number of issues, so that when you have a higher number of new highs and new lows, you should adjust that for right. how the market changes. And Jim Mika also added a few filters to those rules, one of which was the McClellan oscillator being looked at as part of evaluating whether you had a signal or not. The basic idea of the Hindenburg Omen is that when you see higher numbers of both new highs and new lows on the same day, then that's a sign of market rotation that can be troublesome.
And also, at the same time, you need to be seeing the McClellan oscillator moving lower, right?
Right. And that's one of the filters that Mika added.
Right.
He says, if you're in an uptrend and it keeps trending upward, you don't have anything to worry about. But if it seems like you're in an uptrend, and you get one of these signals with the new highs and new lows, and when you get a negative indication from a fast-responding indicator like the McClellan oscillator, then you're starting to add up a bunch of different things that are telling you that, hey, this might be something to worry about. And so we got a few of those that flashed in August and got everybody excited, and it was followed in the media. There were probably millions and millions of Google results for Hindenburg Omen with blogs and people talking about it, and mm-hmm. even got mentioned on Glenn Beck, of all things.
Oh.
And, when something captures the public's imagination that deeply, it's probably not going to work.
Yeah, exactly.
If everybody thinks it's going to work, then it can't possibly work.
I think that,
and
I think
sure
that
enough,
wasn't it also that you had to do it twice within 30 days? This had to happen?
There's a lot of rules, and people can look on the internet and find out more about the specifics of the rules, but I would tell you that the rules that were posted on Wikipedia, I should tell you, up until recently were not the correct rules, not the correct parameters. So take them for what it's worth. You can look elsewhere and find some better descriptions.
Yeah, we use actually Bloomberg, after I guess all the publicity, the professional series of Bloomberg, actually put the Hindenburg indicator on the Bloomberg terminal, so that you could actually do a chart, and then it says, okay, here it is, if it meets all these parameters. That's how public became, and how it actually backed up into the professional space. I thought that was really interesting. But again, it is all about the marketing of that, so that's kind of interesting. So now, I wanted to explain something, because I think this is one of the I could debate you, and maybe not debate you, but even if you try to convince me, I'm going to sit there and just gloss over when we talk about the lunar cycles and when we talk about some of these other cycles. So I don't even want to go there, because I really
That's fine.
It sounds a little, I think it's a little odd.
I'm dubious as well.
Yeah,
I think they're worth looking at just so that you can dismiss them properly, as opposed to dismissing them out of hand. You ought to look at the data and then dismiss it first.
One of my favorite cycle investments, I got to tell you, and it seems like the presidential cycle in a way it would work, is the congressional cycle. When there is a mutual fund, I believe, or a money manager that only invests in the market fully in when Congress is out of session. And he takes it out.
Yeah, there was a study by some academics that came out in 2005, and it works. It really works. I back-tested the data, and I verified it, and sure enough, it works. It doesn't work really great.
Right.
It just gives you enough of an edge over a long period of time that it's meaningful. But there's some validity to that. And you have to understand, though, that the big ugly things that have happened in the market, like the crash of 87 mm-hmm. and the crash of 1929 and the big part of the decline in 29, those happened to happen while Congress was in session. If the crash of 87 had occurred in August when Congress was in recess, then we would have changed the numbers and the outcome of the statistics would have been different.
Right, exactly. And who knows? I mean, I remember that when Congress was voting in 2008, was it 2009, when they were voting on the TARP and the various stimulus, I mean, the market was going through some very serious movement at the time. So they can actually have a lot to play in this area. So, but let's talk about the whole idea of something that I think most people don't understand, and I think it's a very, very useful tool, and that is using the McClellan oscillator to get directional movements on the market. And there's a summation index and all that too, but there's something that you talk about rather regularly, which is when to find bulls or bears in charge of the market and how to identify the above the line complex looking chart versus a simple chart, let's say. And lately you've gone against what you thought would look like a complex above the line and said that, you know, at the same time, everything is looking rather generally, you know, rather that there's going to be potentially a sell-off here. So take me through what above the line complex simple is and why you would, and what that means, and then why you would violate those.
Well, this is great. You got me doing charts on the radio. This is kind of tough. The basic idea for people who are not familiar with the McClellan oscillator is that it's an indicator that moves back and forth across a zero line. Any oscillator, whether it's MACD or stochastics or RSI, they all share one property, which is that they have a neutral level. They have a value which it would return to if, you know, suddenly all the prices stop moving. The McClellan oscillator is the same, and it gets to extremes at very high levels and very low levels, and it can also show divergences. That's a nice thing. If you imagine that an indicator could cross above the zero line, then it can either turn around and go straight back down, leaving just a sharp, pointy structure, or it can stay up there and chop around looking like shag carpeting. When you see a complex structure in the McClellan oscillator on one side of zero or on the other side of zero, that is a piece of evidence which tells you that that side is the strong side of the market. Either where the bulls are strong because they can make a complex structure above zero on the oscillator, or the bears are strong because they can make a complex structure on the south side of zero. If you see the oscillator cross over and spend just a couple of days and then it turns right around and comes back, leaving something that looks like a fang or just a stalactite, that's a simple structure, and it implies weakness for whichever side was able to do that. That's the basics of what you're talking about. People can try to get a better idea of this by looking at the chart of the McClellan oscillator that's on our website. It's mcoscillator.com, MC oscillator. I like to say it's like a McNugget, except it's a McOscillator. or you can just do a web search on McClellan oscillator. You'll find this. You can get an idea for what that looks like, what he's talking about.
Yeah, I think that was really interesting. And one of the things recently I know that the structure was getting weaker on above the bullish line, for example. And this happened in times past also. We're not specifically identifying any particular time right now or whatever. But when do you violate that rule that you may say, you know what, I see that there is a complex structure above the line, but at the same time, I'm not going to play in the bullish camp or vice versa?
It's a great question, and there's not one good answer. But let me give you some general guidelines. When I said that that having a complex structure is a piece of evidence, that's all it is. It's one piece of evidence. That doesn't mean that it's completely authoritative. It doesn't mean it can't be overcome. But generally speaking, if you have a complex structure above zero, that's bullish evidence. If the oscillator were to dip below zero, come back up above zero, and make only a simple structure mm-hmm. above zero, then that's your message that, okay, the bulls are now no longer in charge. They're no longer strong. The bears might not yet be in charge because we don't have that evidence yet. All you have is that the bulls have gotten to fourth down and they've punted.
So when you invest, I know that you have a variety of different methodologies, and you use the summation index, you use the AD line, you're using a lot of different things that go into this. You know, what do you combine as and what can you tell people to be looking at? Like, you know, sometimes it's, I think people get it too simply or think it's too simply. They could use simple to use a stochastic cross, simple cross as for everything. But, you know, the fact is that we've had studies. I don't know if I told you this, that we have a back testing system now. Did I tell you that?
Great.
I don't know if I told you. So if you wanted to back test something, just lay it on me. But we could take, for example, an index, you know, the S&P 500, the Dow, and you could say, okay, throw on a simple, you know, 14.3, whatever, or a MACD or a stochastics, whatever you want, and tell me historically how that's done. As a matter of fact, we could throw several on and look at which was the historical best one and then find out, you know, where the problems were. And, you know, you find that many of these are good on certain, let's say, individual stocks, possibly, or some indices, but not everyone is good for every single indice or stock. Does that? Do you agree with that?
Yep.
Yeah.
Or at any particular period of time.
Right.
The one weakness that a lot of chartists and technicians fall into is thinking that I should only use one set of rules all the time.
Right.
Well, the market will be in a trending mode maybe a third to a half of the time. The other part, it's just chopping sideways.
Right.
And so if you can have a better understanding of which mode you're in, are we in a choppy sideways or are we in a trending condition, that'll help you know which set of indicators to look at. If you can conclude that we're in a choppy market and, my gosh, we're overbought or we're oversold, then you should know to try to do the reverse. But if you're in a trending market, you don't want to sell an overbought condition because the market can stay overbought for a long time in an uptrend. And it can, and as we saw in 2008, it can stay oversold for a long time in a downtrend.
Right.
So it's important to understand what kind of market you're in, what kind of trending condition you're in, and so you have to find ways to figure that out. One of the ways is through planning and through forecasting. When are we likely to be in that kind of condition? And during the seasonally strong period from November to May, you're more likely to be in an uptrend. During May to October, you're more likely to be in a choppy or sideways or down trend. So you can do some planning, but then you can also look at indicators like ADX and like looking at the McClellan oscillator's complex or simple structure to tell you whether it's the trending or if it's a sideways condition.
Right. And there's some things that give you, there's a lot of indicators that give you extreme measures that you could look at also. Like the TRIN or the
ARMS index.
The ARMS index, for example. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of little things that you can look at here and there, but I still think that it takes a little time for a chart. You can't just say, oh, the MACD crossed below the line and now that's a buy, or crossed above the line is a buy, or sell or short. You know, the problem is that becomes too simplistic, and if it was that easy, you would be making money on everything that you do here. So I think that that the lesson from this discussion, I think, is that charting is great, but yet you have to use it in the right mode. In other words, simply, you know, wearing a bathing suit is just great if it's summertime, but in the winter, it's not as useful. So
that's a good point. Yeah,
you know, you have
to. You can't get by on only having just one bathing suit.
Right, exactly.
Your entire wardrobe.
Right. So you have to adapt, and you have to be constantly looking at different places. But there is some home bases, if you will, some areas that you go each time to say, okay, where are we? Where is the market? And that's why I like the McClellan indicator so much, and the daily pieces that you write on that. Let's talk about gold for a second. I know you've been rather neutral on gold, and gold, if the markets are bad, if the economies are bad, are going up. If the markets are good and the economy is good, it goes up. If there's no information at all, it goes up. What is the story?
Well, we switched to neutral a little while ago on gold just because it had gotten real expensive, I saw the risk to the downside exceeded the potential to the upside. It's continued going up a little bit more since our change to neutral, and I'm happy to let it do that. But I see problems with I see good and I see bad. The problems that I see gold running into is that there is an important major cycle in gold that's 13 and a half months long, and it's due to bottom in January of 2011. So at some point before that time, you have to reach a top in order for it to have some period of time to go down into that bottom. We're likely close to the point where it can do that. The good thing, though, is that we have seen the price of gold make its higher high late in that cycle. In other words, we're real close to the next cycle bottom, which is only 3 months away. It's been 10 months since the last one, and we're making higher highs. When it does that, cycle analysis people call that a right translation. In other words, if you're making higher highs late in the cycle, that's a bullish development. If you're making the highest high early in the cycle and making a lower high late in the cycle, that's a bearish development, and that's what you saw just prior to gold's last big decline in 2008. We're not seeing that now. So, yes, there's a cycle bottom due in January, but we don't necessarily have to do that much damage between now and when that cycle bottom arrives. I would be much more excited about gold in January 2011 because we'll be past the time that we're in right now where everybody's getting excited about gold, which is usually not the time to be the one jumping on the bandwagon, and it'll also be the beginning of the up phase of the next cycle when you're much more likely to get some rapid upward movement.
Right. I mean, everybody's on the bandwagon. It's really ridiculous. I can't go an evening without watching TV without finding a gold blah, blah, blah commercial about how great gold is and, you know, how I have to, you know, buy this, you know, gold-plated coin of sorts. Or you heard recently there is a brand new, this is not, I'm not kidding, there's a brand new ATM that does not dispense currency. It dispenses little gold pieces.
Yeah, they're real popular all throughout Europe and the Middle East.
Yeah, that's kind of, that's spooky to say the least, you know, where you have that going on. But you know what? It is what it is, and right now people have a lack. It shows, obviously, the lack of conviction and the lack of respect that people have for currencies, which is a translation to the lack of respect they have to the people that are handling the currencies. And I'll tell you something, Tom. I have never seen such currency moves in my career. Have you?
Well, I started out maybe a little earlier than you. I remember some wild currency goings on in the 1980s before I even got started analyzing the stock market. There were a lot more currencies back then to have some wild things
going on before
all of Europe got consolidated into one. We had gotten away for the last 20 years or so from the idea of central banks intervening to prop up currencies or to take down currencies. That's returning as a theme for a new generation of currency players who have never had that as a risk factor. You know, all of a sudden the Bank of Japan will decide to intervene and your currency holdings just move 2%. And then what do? And your model was built on the data for the last 20 years where that wasn't a risk factor.
Right.
So a lot of people are going to get a quick education about what it's like to operate in currencies in a world and in a new period where central banks get a little bit more ambitious about changing the values of those currencies.
Yep, and already Japan has come out with a statement last week or so that said that, you know, they're seeing currency moves to be excessive. You're seeing the fight between the U.S. and Congress and the yuan. You're seeing the euro just spin out of control in every direction, you know, up and down. And when I say that, the old days, a currency move of 1% was considered a lot. Now we can have a 1.5% to 2% on a currency in a day, and nobody seems to mind as much. I mean, I'm telling you, I remember the old days when you saw a 1% move on the currency, you get under your desk. Just don't come out for a while, you know?
And all the Forex brokers have not yet adjusted their parameters for margin calls on the people that are trading with them. So you need to make that mental adjustment or you're going to have it adjusted for you if you're a Forex trader.
Exactly.
But the other thing that we should understand about what happened when the Bank of Japan intervened in early September, that set off a huge shift in the data that we watch on the commitment of traders numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Previously, overall, the smart money traders, the commercials, had been about neutral on the dollar overall, and they'd been hugely bearish on the dollar index. There's been a huge change in the 3 weeks since they made that announcement by the Bank of Japan. Now the commercials, the smart money, they are jumping into the dollar. Even though it's falling like a stone, they're getting all over it. They are saying something's coming. Something is coming that's going to make the dollar seem like the place to be, and they're going to try to get in ahead of it. I don't know
At the end of the day, Tom, listen, let's agree to this. At the end of the day, China says they're buying euro and euro bonds. They're going to go into Greece and buy their bonds if they can come up with a real budgetary commitment that makes sense, which, you know, I'd like to see that. But they've been buying euros. Obviously, we know that China and a few other areas have been propping up the euro right now. They need to keep that up so they can have their exports, you know, be well in line, because they're not as closely tied to the currency as they are the dollar. But also, at the same time, you know, at the end of the day, when the scare is in people, for whatever reason, they're coming back to the dollar. They're coming back to the yen. They're coming back to the dollar. And no matter
well, the commercials are getting there ahead of of people coming back to it. The dollar's been falling really rapidly. The euro's been going up faster than I've ever seen it go up at a greater rate of change. And the commercial traders, the smart money guys, the big money houses, they are responding by moving as fast as I've ever seen them move to a long position overall in the dollar.
Right.
So that tells me something's coming that's going to push the dollar up. And that may have an effect on the stock market for a while. It also feeds into the idea that gold's getting a little toppy here for the near term, just for this episode of the 13.5-month cycle. I don't think that we're at the end of the uptrend in gold for a long time, mostly because the Fed has shown willingness to stick with keeping short-term rates below the inflation rate for the foreseeable future.
Right.
Whenever you do that, that's tremendously stimulative to gold.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, listen, I'm going to send you our... We just actually put out a new piece. We have a very detailed commitment of traders I'm going to send you. I don't think I've sent you this before, but I'm going to send you the one we have. And we also have... We're writing about that and explaining that a little bit more because a lot of people have questions about what is the commitment of traders. And there's been some changes in the commitment of traders just recently, I think 2 months ago, where they've actually separated further, not just usually they have the speculators, the commercial, and the others, right? They've separated the into about five different divisions now for the S&P.
And it's hard to know what to do with that data since we don't have years and years of
right.
it to study.
Exactly. But it's better. It's better at least that they did separate the commercials and the speculators. That was good because and put up rules about a year ago or so. But, you know, that's a good thing that they did. But at the same time, now they're coming out with even more things, trying to expand it further. You know, soon we're going to be counting each individual person's hand. So, Tom McClellan, I'll put all of the links, of course, on the show notes. I encourage everybody to check out. You can get a, do you do free trials? I always forget this stuff. I'm sorry. Do you do free trials or anything?
We don't do free trials, but we have sample issues of our newsletter on our website. People can take a look at the past issue and just to see what it entails. We also have a money back guarantee if they subscribe with us and decide it's not for them. Give us a fair look. We'll refund the balance upon request.
All right, great stuff.
It's as frisky as it can be.
That's great stuff. Mr. McClellan, I appreciate your time here, and watch for the email for that information I send over to you on the commitment of traders. All right, Tom McClellan, great guest to have. Very smart, insightful fella, I think. And I really do encourage you to check out his daily edition, if nothing else. It gives you some really neat insight into advanced decliners and some directional movements for the market. Listen, there's no one particular way to look at the market in terms of direction. You know, there are so many different indicators out there. And I think Tom discusses the fact that not every one of them is right all the time. You'll find, as a matter of fact, that many of them are wrong. One of the things that we've done is to look at, for example, I'll give you a couple examples. So MACD, a lot of technical analysts like to look at MACD. A lot of newer to the scene investors like to look at MACD, which is the moving average divergence indicator, to find out when it's crossing. They look at stochastics. They look at RSI. The interesting thing here is that when we look at the RSI, the stochastic, and the MACD, sometimes you get false signals. Okay. In addition to that, oftentimes a signal will give you an overbought or an oversold reading much longer than you would like to see if you were thinking that the condition was either overbought or oversold. So for example, you know, stock ABC or market ABC is trending in direction, let's say it's moving up, and then you have a stochastic that is above your maximum level, usually about 70 or so, on the stochastic oscillator, and it's just kind of hanging out there, straight lining across as the market continues to move higher. If you looked at that necessarily and said, well, it's overbought, I'm going to be concerned about this, well, that's not enough. If you said, well, I'm going to wait till the stochastic then turns down, I'm going to see the short line cross the longer term line, depending on how you set up your stochastic, and I'm going to wait till it moves below the actual overbought line. So it's going to have to come through and I'm going to get multiple confirmations. That may be something that you can use. But don't believe that just an overbought or an oversold situation is the only thing that you have to look at. Now, lots to talk about there. We'll bring that up in another episode maybe with Corey Rosenberg, one of our technical specialists. But I thought what we'd do is we'd go back to answer some questions with regard to just whatever you had on your mind. Again, you could just write to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and I'll be happy to do my best to put it on. Some of these are a little bit older, not that old, but you know, older in the queue. But I thought I wanted to get to some of these. So let's see what we have here. All right. All right, so our first question comes from WN Tap. You'll know who you are. It says, Dear Andrew, just a note to tell you how much I enjoyed your podcast, which I subscribe to through iTunes. I have found your speaking style to be most listenable I have ever heard. Your program is entertaining as it is informative. Appreciate your personality, knowledge, sense of humor, and great guests. I had to read that. That was great. This is from Wesley, actually. Thanks, Wesley. That's awesome. I can't believe that somebody actually believes that I have this wonderful speaking style. It just doesn't seem to be the case that I, you know, sometimes when you hear yourself, it's like, oh, I sound nasal. I talk too fast. You know, I'm sounding like I'm reading something. What's going on? Anyway, thanks so much for that. I appreciate that. Now, he goes through a lot of different discussion about different newsletters that he has and some books that he read and some other things that he talked about. But he says, please give me more trader interviews and discussions on techniques, stock screens, programs, and things of that nature. How do you interpret the COT, the Commitment of Traders graph, on the bottom of FinViz and S&P futures chart? And how might that indicate market sentiment? Okay, a couple of things. This is really important. I talked about commitment of traders a moment ago with Tom McClellan and something that he looks at. And they come in the forms of commitment of traders to different futures markets. So you'll have the futures in, let's say, financial instruments like the S&P 500, the E-minis. You'll have the commitment of traders to the dollar, another futures market or currency. You'll have a commitment of traders that is looking at maybe various commodities, gold or oil or maybe even soybeans or cattle. Now, what you want to look at is they split the commitment of traders up into several different groups. The main three groups are, one would be you see speculators, you see commercial, and other. Other usually is retail, commercial are the big boys, and speculators are maybe the mid-size and smaller hedge funds. You want to track the first two, really, but more so the commercial for most of these. You want to look at where the commercial is moving. Now, let me give you a tremendous, tremendous warning here. The Commitment to Traders report is actually a trading, it comes out once a week, and it is a trading report that shows the Tuesday numbers, but doesn't come out until Friday, late Friday. So when you're looking at that and you're seeing something happen, realize that it's about a five-day lag. And look at the last date. So if you're looking at Monday or Tuesday, you're actually looking at a week ago. Okay? Understand that. So you have to realize that you know, the information is a bit aged, let's say, when you're looking at it. And look at the dates that you're looking at. But essentially what you want to see is the direction that the commercials, for the most part, are moving in. And oftentimes, you want to look at the other or the retail as a contrarian indicator. That's what the commitment of traders usually is used for. And unfortunately, folks, what they call it is the smart money and dumb money. Not a nice thing to say about retail investors, but that's what they say. The smart money is moving in this direction, the commercial traders, maybe even the speculators to a degree. The dumb money or retail, again, I'm not saying that. I'm just telling you what it's called. Is moving in this direction, usually late to the party. So that's what's going on there. And I thank you for your not only your kind question, but your nice comment on my style. I have style. All right, who's this from? This is coming from James, JLH. He talked about a little bit about an interview with Kate Stalter we did recently, and he likes Kate. And he said that he used to subscribe to IBD, no longer. Here are his observations. And basically he's saying here, let me just kind of summarize this. They have a great amount of content and a huge number of stock ideas, which are good and bad. I realize I don't have nearly the time to adequately go through all these. Besides, it's loaded with companies that William O'Neill himself wouldn't buy, which is interesting. I'd like to actually challenge you on that. He's known for concentrating just a few of the best leading companies. Well, I guess the point is that he believes that maybe a 5 or 10, maybe even 20 position portfolio would be the best place to be. I suppose, versus the 100, of course. Okay, so now it says he never connected with the IBD system of buying breakouts, and so too many of them failed even in uptrends. I also feel that many people take great liberties with the cup and handle. I agree with that. You know, the problem is there's a very specific methodology here. Whether it works or not is something aside for a moment, but there's this very specific methodology here, and you need to realize that when it comes to the various different types of rules that they have, I do agree that people take a lot of liberties with that. And He says, this I didn't really understand. James, I didn't get this whole point. One has to wonder why, after so many books written and sold and so many seminars over the years, there are so few success stories under this strategy. I've been part of the forum for years, and there can only be a handful. I mean, 3 to 5 people have documented their success. I don't know. I don't know what to say about this. Maybe I'll pass this on to Kate to have her answer it, because I'm not in the business of defending them. I like them. Obviously, you have not had success with, for whatever reason, with using their system. Next up here, let's see. This is from Demarius. He says, "Hi, Andrew. I actually went back and listened to podcast episode 148 with Harry Dent, and there seems to be a ton of truth in his evaluation of our economic situation." So where are we now? We're up to 182. So this is like 40 weeks ago. Thanks. He said that, "I started listening to your podcast in 2007. I listened to the podcast that Mr. Dent was on, and that podcast is the sole reason I pulled my money out of the market in December 2007. That was the original one. Thanks. Many concern today, however, is the growing debt that our country is accumulating, and I don't believe it'll ever get balanced, and I believe that we're headed for our own currency crisis and is almost unavoidable. I hope I am wrong, but hope won't fix the situation unless government spending will, and I don't see that happening in the foreseeable future. What are my thoughts?" You know, we're talking about, since the time you listened to that episode number 148 to now, obviously was a long period of time ago, almost a year. But at the same time, I can't really argue the fact that the currency situation is getting out of control. You know, the dollar being pushed down like it is now is more of extraneous measures that's being used rather than the Fed. Just the Fed talking and possibly doing some buybacks is not enough to move the dollar index down almost 7% in the last month. That is a whopping number. The dollar index, they call it Dixie, is down like 7% against the main currencies around the world in the last month or so. Now, what's happening is we're seeing the Japanese get in the fray and all. This is a bad situation, and we are headed to a problem here. It doesn't necessarily have to be a tremendous blow-up problem, but there's something that has to be said about how we're handling this currency, and we're using the currency as a political tool, a mechanism, to get what we want and to try to get our country strong. Now, I'm speaking not only of us, but everybody around the world. So there is some concern there, and I'm sure that everybody is thinking that there is a problem here when we do see concern around the world and the yen goes up and the dollar keeps on trending down and the euro goes up. I can't imagine that the euro is the go-to currency at this point by any mechanism, by any method, and by anyone's imagination. All right, so I have another question from Ricky. And Ricky writes, "By now I'm sure that you've seen the following headline or something similar. One large trader led to the May 6 stock market plunge. Given the largest computerized institutional trades will become more prevalent in the years and decades to come, how can an average investor, even with the help of someone such as yourself," that's where it ends. What does that mean? How can an average such as yourself? "The playing field has never been level for the average Joe investor, AJI, but technology innovations are making things even worse. Can there be a strategy addition to your fund that somehow captures that, essentially adding a parameter attempting to characterize the extra volatility? Just curious. I eagerly listen to your podcast and have learned an immense amount from you and your guests. Thanks for putting out the podcast. You probably don't hear that enough often." Thank you so much, Ricky. I appreciate that. And by the way, you're free to write me anytime, anybody out there, telling me either that you like my speaking style or that you like the podcast or you don't like the podcast, whatever it is. I'd appreciate your feedback. Again, it's askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Ricky, the answer to your question is very complicated. The trade that led to the stock market plunge that was looked at as an initiation of a firm in a hedging strategy sent down the S&P futures. They bought just a chunk of E-mini futures, and without liquidity on the rest of the market, a lot of sell stops in place, it just broke the bank at that point. But given that it came back so quickly, at least reasonably quickly, from that level, you have to realize that there is a problem. But at the same time, it wasn't, necessarily, out of whack. I mean, right now we have things that are being put into the marketplace. We have a lot of various, we'll call it, triggers and halts and circuit breakers. I don't know if they'll work. We'll have to see how that works. The large computer institutional traders are a big problem. The volatility is very difficult because it doesn't happen very much in any kind of regularity, except for like 230, 245, where you see that big run-up usually, or the opening and the closing. you know, there is this kind of, you know, when they're dealing with the machinery, they're moving things around with using futures. They're using E-mini futures. They're using a variety of option strategies. They're using just, you know, ETFs. And they're doing arbitrage and moves things in either direction. And, you know, you have to, in a way, kind of think of that as noise. It's tough. It's very tough. But you need to think of that as noise and not the May 6th. That was not noise. That was earth-shattering. But this volatility issue, that's the game they're in. I think you have to look beyond that and look for great opportunities in individual positions, in areas, sectors, in bull market runs or bear market, you know, drops, and look for that. I think that's the better solution here, because you're really never going to capture all that volatility inside of what's going on with those machines. And then the last I have here is a question that we're going to talk about today is from Trader's Apprentice. And he says, Andrew, thanks for hosting such a great investing show and uncovering some of the Wall Street secrets us plebeians not privy to. I found your podcast right after I exited a massive short position I've accumulated between July 7th through November 7th. Unfortunately, I exited the trade at break-even after seeing the market rally all the way back to 14,200. While I was at this trade, I couldn't understand why the market was rising and why all the experts couldn't see the macro dangers with so much leverage in the system and such a large amount of GDP dependent on real estate prices. I found your podcast and was like, wow, this guy actually gets and doesn't have some ridiculous long bias. So now let me just kind of give you that as a backdrop of a much longer question here. Then he talks about how he's doing some trading of in and out of E-mini futures and a variety of other things. And he says, basically, his plans have been correct, but due to poor stop management, early timing, and bad entry location, he keeps on getting kind of thrown up in the problem area. He says, this happens too much often to me. I get into a trade early, get stopped out with a big loss, and then while the trade is really going to get profits too quickly. I notice that it typically happens during the first hour of trade. Okay, so, and he asked me what to do about it, et cetera. Here's the point. First hour of trading is used for just first hour of trading. If you're a day trader, you probably want to trade the first hour, maybe 2 hours, and the last 2 hours of the day. So the rest of the time, you can go play golf and whatever you're going to do. The problem is that there's a lot of motion running high. Everybody kind of starts the new day, the new month, the new quarter with a brand new slate. Okay, we're going to get into this. We're going to go into that. And, you know, you have especially those day traders that are getting into positions because they did not have positions the day before. A true day trader never holds their positions overnight. So if you're actually a day trader, you're opening positions somewhere in the first hour or so of the morning, maybe some pre-market, but somewhere in the first hour or so. And then what you're doing is you're going after, from there, you're going after, okay, where is this going to play out? Where's the swing? Where's the day trade going to happen? I'm going to close my position, et cetera, maybe reopen at the end of the day and either short or long, whatever I'm doing, and play it for that. Because the volatility and liquidity is really what people are looking for when it comes to day trading. I think one of the things that you need to look at here is looking at the overnight markets and setting some wide areas that you may want to look at of possibly stopping out in the overnight, because the overnight does have a lot more, less liquidity, but a lot more range to it. So if you're going short, you may want to take it down about 4 or 5 points and say, hey, if I get this range, I'm happy. Again, you're talking about short-term trading here. At the same time, I think you need to somehow figure out how to take the emotions out of the whole sequence. Go and talk to my friend Fausto Puglisi over at Cyber Trading University. He does a future course, but you really want to talk about how things are playing out in the market. What are the rules to be involved with? Because it seems to me from your note, again, what you wrote me at least here, is that you are dealing with an emotional situation. That's what you wrote. And that is not going to get you anywhere good when it comes to these markets. The volatility is too great. The problems inherent in a low volume, generally low volume environment, is that you're going to see a lot more volatility. And that because so many of the big machines are using futures as their mainstay of what they're doing, this is where you're going to run into some problems because now you're fighting the machines. So, my friend, go talk to Fausto Puglisi at Cyber Trading University. A couple other things I want to mention. We'll cut it short a little bit today and from this week. I think there was a lot of information we went over there. Last week we had Scott O'Neill on. I really encourage you to listen to that. He really goes through the entire brand new MarketSmith program. Also, we had Behind the Numbers on. And I think that you have to listen to that. This gentleman that we talked to was pretty right about what was some of the things that were going to happen. He's been really concerned about CRM, which really took a bath. And a lot of the leaders, I don't know if you saw that earlier in the week, midweek actually, there was a tremendous amount of red. There was a tremendous amount of green before that, but I am talking about a bloodbath. It's almost looked like we had an exhaustion buy point somewhere in this, and then all of a sudden, because of one news item that was basically saying, a company called Equix, that was saying that their revenue is going to be brought down, and they're involved in the server space and the hosting space and the whole cloud, the entire industry, and even if you were peripherally related to the industry, got destroyed. I mean, will this be a buying opportunity moving forward? I don't see any fundamental difference in a company like an F5 maybe. And there's a few others on that list. You know, how does that really affect a CRM? But I think what's happening is you had this great momentum move up over the last, I don't know, couple, 3 weeks, 4 weeks maybe. And you're just getting some people taking their profits on this, which is essentially an earnings warning ahead of the earnings that happened. So I think that's what happened there. We'll see what happens in the next few weeks. You can't tell a couple of days after really what's gone on there. But, you know, I think that it's an interesting phenomenon. We'll have to see how, of course, the entire, technology plays out when it comes to the earnings season. And we're just getting underway with earnings season, so it should be kind of exciting. Anyway, till next week, if you want to contact me, you know how to do it. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And of course, if you're looking for an investment advisor, if you want to find out what we do, how we do it, why we do it, the transparency of what we do and with the write-ups that we do, people love the fact that we write up our commentary each and every week and talk about why we did what we did, some of the things that only our clients can see, just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There'll be a link here that says, hey, take the 14-minute virtual tour. I think you'll enjoy it. For those of you that have been either out the market, not having a good amount of success, you're in the market, you want to be there, you don't want to be there, you're confused, take a look at this. I think it will be very enjoyable for you, and I think it will give you some great insight. So I do appreciate you stopping by and checking that out. Until next week, have a wonderful, wonderful week, a successful week, a very prosperous week as well. I'll see you soon. This is Andrew Horowitz, the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 182. It's all done. See you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.